Today is Saturday, 6 December 2025. And before I start this programme, let me briefly remind you to tick the like button if once you've watched the programme or whichever part of the programme you want to watch, you like what you've heard and you wish to indicate this fact. Now, I am making this programme today very early because, as things have turned out, I have to drive with my family to Oxford to meet a very old friend, and I will be staying in Oxford on Saturday and will be returning to London on Sunday. So this leaves little time for me to do a programme today, and I'm having to do my programme very early in the morning. That inevitably means that I will not be fully up to date with all the news, and also I'm afraid it means that the video today is going to be much shorter than usual. Anyway, let's move on. And briefly, the biggest and most important news over the last 24 hours is that the United States has now published a national strategic assessment, supposedly setting out its ideas about foreign policy and security policy in the future, at least whilst President Trump remains President of the United States. Now, I should say US national security strategy documents are regularly produced by presidential administrations, and it's perhaps unsurprising that the Trump administration has produced its own. And I will also quickly say that, in my opinion, this document bears very much the fingerprints of Elbridge Colby, the Assistant Secretary of War in the Pentagon, who is apparently in overall charge of policy. No doubt there have been other contributors as well. Some of the comments made in this document appear to mirror opinions expressed, for example, by the Vice President J.D. Vance, and other opinions also appear close to those that President Trump himself has given. Well, I would not normally say very much about a document of this kind. As I said, administrations often produce them, and the reality is that the foreign policy of the United States and its security policy is, as far as I can tell, usually little affected by what they say. But this document is so extremely different. It is so exceptionally unlike every other national security strategy document that I have read coming out of the United States for, well, decades, that I feel I absolutely have to say something. Because if this document is to be taken at face value, then it represents a revolutionary moment, a revolutionary statement by the United States, signalling its intention to completely change its entire foreign policy and its entire approach to the world. So I'm going to summarise it, because that's all I can do in a short programme like this. Briefly, the strategy paper says that the United States can no longer pursue a policy of world hegemony or world domination. It actually uses the word domination to describe the policy of previous American administrations. It says that this policy was always unrealistic, that it went beyond American resources and capabilities, and that it actually drained and hollowed out those resources, leaving the United States in the critical state it was allegedly in when President Trump was elected president for the second time. So that's the first thing it says. The second is that it clearly identifies China as the greatest adversary and threat of the United States. It speaks of China almost as a peer competitor, though it is careful to say repeatedly throughout the document that the United States remains the country with the strongest economy, the best science, the most advanced technology, the best financial markets, the most powerful armed forces, all those sort of things. Anyway, China, nonetheless, it does somewhat grudgingly concede, is a major power, a major economic rival, a country that has risen very fast and very, very far, and which is America's primary adversary. And that says, or follows from that, that the primary focus of the United States in seeking to maintain its position as the world's foremost power, and this document is all about that, the primary focus of the United States must be in countering China. It makes actually a very interesting statement buried inside the article, which is that it says that whilst the United States itself is no longer in a position where it can pursue world dominance, the United States must act to ensure that no other country, and that by that obviously it means China, should be permitted to do so. So that, of course, sets up a future of competition and rivalry between the United States and China. And very interestingly, and very importantly, it also has quite a lot to say about Taiwan. It makes it clear that for the United States, any forcible reconquest of Taiwan by China would cross a red line. It says that the key issue here is not Taiwan's leadership in producing chips or semiconductors or anything like that. Rather, it harks back to things said by General Douglas MacArthur way back in the 1950s about how Taiwan is the unsinkable aircraft carrier that enables the United States to dominate the Eastern and Central Pacific. So, for that reason, the United States must not allow, cannot allow, China to reoccupy, to retake control of Taiwan. And it also pointedly says that a third of world trade passes close to the island of Taiwan. So everything is set up for competition and rivalry with China. About other regions of the world, however, the strategy paper has other things to say. Firstly, Latin America falls clearly within the US's sphere of influence. The paper explicitly references the Monroe Doctrine, not the Monroe Doctrine as written by Secretary of State John Quincy Adams and actually set out in a statement to Congress by the then President of the United States, President Monroe, back in the 1820s. Rather, the Monroe Doctrine, as it is nowadays understood, in other words, as a doctrine of absolute, undisputed, unchallenged American dominance of the entire Western Hemisphere of North America and South America, of Canada, of Central America, of South America too. And the document clearly says that no competing power, and again, of course, it means China and perhaps also Russia too, must be allowed to have any kind of military presence in this region. And it also says, somewhat amazingly, that the United States doesn't want the countries of Latin America to conduct even trade with countries that are the United States' geopolitical rivals. What this paper, this document, proposes for South America is, in effect, unconstrained American dominance, a degree of dominance, in fact, a restoration of a degree of dominance that the United States had in this region up to the mid-1970s, but has basically never had since. And this looking back to the past in terms of relations with South America is, by the way, very similar to a lot of the rest of this strategy paper, which is repeatedly looking back to the past. It hankers for a time of US reindustrialization. It wants to place the interests of American workers first. It's very much all about restoring the United States to a position of economic and industrial and manufacturing dominance, but also of dominance of the Western Hemisphere. And as I said, not even economic relations between other great powers, rival great powers, and South American states will be tolerated. Now, I'm going to say very briefly, because as I said, I've only got a short amount of time, that I think this entire strategy is completely unrealistic. The people of South America will have quite a lot to say about all of this. They've had long history of being dominated by the United States, and I strongly get the sense that they don't want to be dominated by it any longer. And perhaps more pressing is, of course, that at nowhere in this document, this strategy paper, is there any recognition of the fact that the United States effectively shares Latin America with another American potential great power, which is, of course, Brazil. Brazil is, of course, a member of the BRICS, and presumably when the United States doesn't want countries in Latin America to maintain economic contacts, economic relations with American great power rivals, that means that the United States wants to see Brazil leave the BRICS. But Brazil is a member of the BRICS. It's got very close trading and economic ties with China. It is a huge country. It has a large population. It's got a big economy, though one that has many profound problems. And it has a massive abundance of natural resources. By every objective metric, Brazil is a country which will one day become a great power, or will at least aspire to achieve that. Now, I find it extremely difficult to imagine that a country like Brazil is going to accept the degree of subordination that this document demands of it. And I find it extremely unlikely too that Brazil will be happy to have the entirety of the rest of the South American continent dominated by the United States. So this document, this paper, it seems to me, sets up a future of rivalry between the United States and Brazil also. But anyway, that's one other thing. The document then also talks about the Middle East. It basically says that the United States has spent far too much time and far too much effort in the Middle East. It continues to regard Iran as the great adversary of the United States in the Middle East. But it says that the Middle East is far less important than it used to be. The United States is economically self-sufficient, as once upon a time it had ceased to be. And the power of the great disruptor in the Middle East, which of course is identified as Iran, has greatly reduced. So the United States, according to this article, is in a position, if not to withdraw from the Middle East completely, at least to give the Middle East less attention and less focus, and to focus and worry more about other places. Well, that's the theory. Again, I am very sceptical about the practice. First of all, I'm not convinced that Iran is anywhere near as reduced in power as the United States appears to suppose. And of course, Iran is now also a member of BRICS. But beyond that, I don't myself think that Iran is the problem in the Middle East. I think that the Arab-Israeli conflict, which the paper only briefly alludes to, is the real cause of the crisis in the Middle East, which I think is getting worse and deeper, and that until and unless this problem, the problem of the conflict between the Israelis and the Palestinians, is resolved, well, the Trump administration might want to forget about the Middle East, but in reality, the Middle East will not forget the United States, America's ally, Israel, its friends in Washington will ensure that that doesn't happen. Anyway, that's all, if you like, a little bit, a summary, but perhaps the most interesting and revealing passage is what this document has to say about relations with Europe. And it must be said that the comments about Europe are absolutely and utterly scathing. It says that continental Europe has been losing share of global GDP, down from 25% in 1990 to 14% today. By the way, the same is true if you use purchasing power parity figures for the United States itself. Just saying. And it says that this is partly owing to national and transnational regulations that undermine creativity and industriousness. This economic decline is eclipsed, however, by the real and more stark prospect of civilizational erasure. The larger issues facing Europe include activities of the European Union and other transnational bodies that undermine political liberty and sovereignty, migration policies that are transferring the continent and creating strife, censorship of free speech and suppression of political opposition, cratering birth rates and loss of national identities and self-confidence. Should present trends continue, the continent will be unrecognizable in 20 years or less. As such, it is far from obvious whether certain European countries will have economies and militaries strong enough to remain reliable allies. Many of these nations are doubling down on their present path. We want Europe to remain European, to regain its civilizational self-confidence, and to abandon its failed focus on regulatory suffocation. And then elsewhere in the article, it actually says that there is even a possibility that the character of some of the European countries might change completely over the next 20 years. They might cease to be European over the long term. It is more than plausible that within a few decades at the latest, certain NATO members will become majority non-European. As such, it is an open question whether they will view their place in the world or their alliance with the United States in the same way as those who signed the NATO Charter. Well, I can absolutely guarantee that the European leaderships will be absolutely furious. They will be seething with anger when they read something like this. They will also be extremely angry when they read about how the Ukraine war has had the perverse effect of increasing Europe's, especially Germany's, external dependencies. Today, German chemical companies are building some of the world's largest processing plants in China using Russian gas that they cannot obtain at home. Well, some of the executives of these German chemical companies will ask, well, whose fault is it that that actually happened? After all, it was the United States that opposed Nord Stream, the Nord Stream pipelines, and wanted them shut down. And, well, I'm not going to get into the discussions as to who exactly it was who blew up the Nord Stream pipelines. The Germans say it was the Ukrainians. But anyway, the point is that they would feel that they have been left, the Germans have been left with no realistic choice. Anyway, let's just go back and note something else, that the document speaks about the larger issues facing Europe include activities of the European Union and other transnational bodies that undermine political liberty and sovereignty, migration policies that are transforming the continent and creating strife, censorship, all that kind of thing. So the European Union is a threat to Europe, and other transnational bodies are threats to Europe too. Which other transnational bodies? NATO? The European Council? I can't help but think that what is being referenced here is, in fact, NATO. So, if that is right, the European Union is bad and it is destroying Europe, and NATO is bad also because it is destroying Europe as well. And as the document says in another place, it is allies of the United States are getting themselves involved in regional conflicts and are sucking in the United States into those conflicts in ways that are not good for American interests. And it is difficult to believe that those words are about anything else than the conflict in Ukraine. Now, again, I have to say that that all seems to me very wild, if I'm understanding this document correctly, because as far as I'm concerned, the single country that is most responsible for the crisis in Ukraine and the war there is none other than the United States. The Europeans obviously have played a role, but to be absolutely clear, it was the United States that funded for many years what was then the Ukrainian opposition. It was the United States that supported the Maidan coup. It was Victoria Nuland, who was an official of the United States, who went onto Maidan Square and handed out the cookies. It was Victoria Nuland again, who in conversations with the US ambassador, Jeffrey Pyatt, picked the leaders of the Ukrainian government. And it was the United States that played an instrumental role in arming Ukraine, assisting Ukraine, inciting the war between Russia and Ukraine. It was the United States that in 2008 pressed for Ukraine to be admitted into NATO. At that disastrous summit meeting, NATO summit meeting in Bucharest, for the United States to now turn round and to say that it was not involved and that the crisis in Ukraine is not its fault, well, all that seems to me, I have to say this, pretty rich. But anyway, let's put all that aside. We can pick on the various historical points, but it's difficult to see comments like the ones that are appearing in this document as anything other than the announcement of a long-term divorce on the part of the United States from Europe. Europe is no longer reliable. It is sinking fast. The European Union is a parasite that is destroying it. And in light of this, it no longer makes sense for the United States to be as involved in Europe as it was. Now, I've said some critical things, but it would be churlish to deny that there is a huge amount here in this analysis of the current state of Europe, which I fully endorse and agree with. I absolutely believe that the policies of the European Union for the last 20 years, 25 years, have been disastrous. I fully believe that Europe is indeed in severe economic decline. Many of the complaints about censorship, suppression of political opposition, cratering birth rates, loss of national identities and self-confidence are, as far as I am concerned, absolutely true. Anyway, let's focus, however, on what it is that the United States wants to achieve. And first of all, it acknowledges straightforwardly that in this situation, where the United States really wants to focus on China and to build up the defences of the Western Hemisphere, the key must be to bring the war in Ukraine to an end. It is a core interest of the United States to negotiate an expeditious cessation of hostilities in Ukraine in order to stabilise European economies, prevent unintended escalation or expansion of the war, and re-establish strategic stability with Russia, as well as to enable the post-hostilities reconstruction of Ukraine to enable its survival as a viable state. I have to say that the last sentence, to enable the post-hostilities reconstruction of Ukraine to enable its survival as a viable state, sounds to me almost as an afterthought. And the article says that the Trump administration finds itself at odds with European officials who hold unrealistic expectations for the war, perched in unstable minority governments, many of which trample on basic principles of democracy to suppress opposition. Well, I cannot disagree with that. That seems to me an accurate statement of the truth. And then it goes on to say, a large European majority wants peace, yet that desire is not translated into policy, in large measure because of those governments' subversion of democratic processes. Well, I'm not sure whether I would go so far as to say that a large majority of Europeans want peace. But I think that is probably basically correct. And as to the rest of that sentence, that this desire is not translated into policy, in large measure because of governments, European governments, subversion of democratic processes. Well, that again, I cannot at all take issue with. About that also, I agree. And the paper then sets out what the priorities are. Re-establishing conditions of stability within Europe and strategic stability with Russia, enabling Europe to stand on its own feet and operate as a group of aligned sovereign nations. Notice the word sovereign nations. So no longer perhaps a union, a European union anymore, to say, including by taking primary responsibility for its own defence without being dominated by any adversarial power. That may be very much to ask if the United States seriously believes that Europe is in a position of hard power to counter Russia by itself, which is, by the way, what in another place this paper says. Well, I think the authors of this paper might be disappointed. And then it says that it says all sorts of other things that Europe must do and that the United States must do. But that is the core of it. Re-establishing conditions of stability within Europe and strategic stability with Russia, enabling Europe to stand on its own feet. In other words, no longer to depend to the extent that it has done since the Second World War on the United States. Now, the Russians will read this document as the Europeans will read this document. And the Europeans, I should say, are going to be absolutely, absolutely horrified by it and furious about it. They will not like at all the way they and their continent is being characterized. They will be infuriated by the criticisms which are being made of the European Union. Ursula von der Leyen and Kaja Kallas will be beside themselves with rage, as will Friedrich Merz and other German politicians, Europeanists as they are, all of them. And Emmanuel Macron will also be furious as well. Incidentally, since I'm on the topic of Emmanuel Macron, he's just been on a trip to China. He met Xi Jinping. He again lectured Xi Jinping about all kinds of things, as European officials and leaders now invariably do. He demanded, and I don't think that's a mischaracterization of what he was up to, he demanded that China take action to rein in Russia in Ukraine. He demanded that China support his latest project, which is getting the Russians to observe and, as far as I can tell, indefinite ceasefire on attacks on the Ukrainian energy system. He also, from what I can tell, was suggesting that if the Russians must continue to conduct attacks against Ukraine's energy system, they should provide the Ukrainians and with advanced notice of when and what they are going to attack. I have to say that if he really did suggest the last to Xi Jinping, then I suspect that Xi Jinping, a extremely polite man, by the way. That is what I have heard. With a poker face. But anyway, I have to assume that Xi Jinping, if he was really presented with that idea by Emmanuel Macron, must have thought to himself that he had a madman in front of him. Because really, to suggest that a party in a war actually give advance notice to the other party which it is fighting of where its attacks are going to take place and at what time those attacks are going to take place. Well, all I can say is that that has never happened in any war, and I cannot imagine that it will happen in this one. But anyway, Macron will be furious with this American document. He got a total rebuff, as far as I can tell, from the Chinese. They were not prepared to help him in any way with respect to the crisis in Ukraine. Xi Jinping instead simply repeated the usual Chinese mantra that China will support any measure that works towards achieving peace in Ukraine. And of course, he's already said many times that he considers that the Russians are working hard precisely with the purpose of achieving peace in Ukraine. So why should China put pressure on them? Just saying. But anyway, Macron will be furious with this American document. I mean, it cuts him down to size. It cuts his beloved Europe down to size. And, well, it doesn't even mention France, just to say. And it treats France pretty much as it treats all of the other European states, as a declining civilization in a state of advanced decay. He will be, as I said, livid about all of this. On the topic of Macron, still, by the way, he's now been talking still about the need to keep on supporting Ukraine. And he accepts somewhat grudgingly that there will have to be negotiations. But if I have understood him correctly, he's again putting himself forward as the lead negotiator, not just from what I can tell on behalf of the European Union, but on behalf of the entire collective West. Well, that is a complete fantasy. I cannot imagine that other European leaders, let alone the Americans, let alone the Russians, would ever agree to this. But anyway, put all that aside, I just mentioned the expression collective West. I can't really see how, after a document like this, if it is ever enforced, that concept will have very much meaning before long, because this document basically calls time on the collective West. Arguably, it calls time on NATO and US involvement in Europe altogether. When the Americans say that they want to re-establish conditions of stability within Europe and strategic stability within Russia, what they're basically saying is that they want things in Europe to quieten down so that they can pack their bags and go, so that they can focus on Latin America and on East Asia. They don't want the Russians making trouble in Europe, and they want the Europeans to sort out and take care of themselves. Now, those ideas, that kind of thinking, is obviously incompatible with any concept of the collective West and any concept ultimately of a North Atlantic alliance as it has existed since the Second World War. Now, there's a number of things to say here. The Russians, as I said, will read this document, and they will say to themselves, this, they will say to themselves, let's consider these words. Let's consider these words in this document. It is a core interest of the United States to negotiate an expeditious cessation of hostilities in Ukraine. A core interest, and that this must be done expeditiously. The Russians are going to say that the Americans are desperate. They want to end this as quickly as possible. They want to end it because it is a core interest for them to end it. Probably, even though this document nowhere admits it, it's a core interest because the Americans don't want to lose the war. Period. It is a core interest because the Americans understand that they're overextended and they're facing this colossal challenge from China. It is a core interest because, despite the bragging in this document, the United States is not anywhere near as strong as it pretends. If it was, it wouldn't need to write a document of this kind. So the Russians are going to say to themselves this, well, we are in an even stronger position than we knew. Our armies are advancing. Ukraine's army is collapsing. Our economy is strong and stable. Our alliances are strong and stable. The Americans, however, are desperate to end the war. If we hold out, if we stick to our positions, then the Americans will have no choice but to settle this conflict on our terms. So there is no incentive, no reason for us to compromise on anything. It's not as if the Russians, it must be said, have shown any great interest or desire to compromise. But after they read a document like this, they will say, well, let's stick to our positions because ultimately the Americans are going to concede them. It is like the Paris negotiation between the United States and North Vietnam. It was a core interest of the United States at that time to negotiate an expeditious cessation of hostilities between itself and North Vietnam. The Paris negotiations were extremely difficult, but eventually the Americans basically conceded to all of the demands that the North Vietnamese were making. This despite all of the attempts to put pressure on North Vietnam, the Christmas bombing in 1972, for example, all of those things. Ultimately, the North Vietnamese knew that if they dug in their heels, they would get the deal they wanted. And the Russians have just been told the same thing. I suspect that the reason this is so straightforwardly set out in this document is because the Americans know that the Russians know it already. What this document says explicitly, the Americans know, the Russians already understand. So there it is. There's not going to be a settlement of this conflict in Ukraine on anything other than Russian terms. Because as far as the Russians are concerned, the only player that ultimately matters is the United States, and the United States has as a core interest an expeditious cessation of hostilities in Ukraine as quickly as possible in order to re-establish strategic stability with Russia. The Russians, Putin, are indeed in the driver's seat, as many people have said. Now, there's an awful lot more I could say about this document, and no doubt I will say over the next couple of days. But there is one central and overriding and very important thing that must be said too. There is a lot about this document which, as I said, is completely different. In fact, the document as a whole is completely different from the strategic surveys or statements that the United States has churned out in times past. In fact, having read many of these documents published by the US government, I cannot convey how different this one is. It feels, it reads completely different, and with some important qualifications, I should say that I welcome overall its realism. But is this really what the United States is actually going to do? Is it really going to withdraw from Europe and from the Middle East? Is it really going to turn its back on NATO? Is it really going to pursue as its core interest a cessation of hostilities in Ukraine? Well, the people who have authored this report, perhaps President Trump himself, perhaps some other officials in the administration, perhaps a large proportion of the US population, or at least the informed part of the US population, perhaps the MAGA movement, are behind, all of them, fully behind this document. But the neocons, the Democrats in Congress, the deep state, the arms industries, all of these people, they absolutely are not. Withdraw from the Middle East, withdraw from Europe, give up on NATO, let the Russians win in Ukraine. You must be joking, they will say. And they will push back on this relentlessly hard. Is this document ultimately going to make any difference? Well, we'll just have to wait and see. But it is still nonetheless a remarkable thing that a document like this has been published at all. And to repeat again, its immediate effect will be in Moscow, people will say to each other, the Americans want to end the conflict in Ukraine. They've told us this in private. They're now saying it in public. We don't need to compromise. We don't need to concede on any substantive issue because the Americans are going to come round to our thinking in due course anyway. And by the way, given how scathing the American comments are about the European Union, who in Moscow now will doubt or would argue that Russia must agree to Ukraine joining the EU as part of a settlement deal? Will people like Medvedev and Lavrov and others now come along to Putin and say to him, look, there's no sense in our agreeing any longer for Ukraine to join the EU. Look at what the Americans are saying about the EU. They're not going to really push back hard or object if we say, no, Ukraine cannot join the EU. The Americans, or at least the people in this administration, hate the EU as much as we do. So anyway, that's where we are. That's what this document represents. Now, Witkoff and Kushner are due to meet Umerov and Gnatov. Gnatov from Ukraine tomorrow. We will see what comes of that. General Sirsky, the Ukrainian commander, has just come out and said that there must be no possibility of Ukraine giving up or surrendering any inch of its territory. I don't know how many people in Ukraine listen to him. Mariana Bezuglaya, the dissident Ukrainian MP, has just given a fiery speech to the Ukrainian parliament in which she has again called for Sirsky's dismissal, blaming him for the fall of Pokrovsk and for the encirclement of the Ukrainian troops in Mirnograd. Just saying. And, well, since we're on the topic of Ukraine, I suspect that the writing now generally is on the wall for Vladimir Zelensky, because an article has now appeared in the New York Times which criticises Zelensky for tolerating and permitting the spread of corruption, especially since the war began. And it seems to me that it is only one small step between criticising a political leader for tolerating corruption and accusing that same political leader of being involved in corruption. And again, the Americans, the New York Times no less, coming out and making these criticisms of Zelensky, talking about the corruption he has allowed in Ukraine. I can't help but wonder whether, when that accusation in the United States of Zelensky's corruption comes, I can't help but think that at that point, for Zelensky, it will all be over. The one thing I suspect he cannot survive is a potential indictment or investigation on corruption, on potential corruption charges, activated and conducted openly against him by the United States. Now, yesterday in my programme, I alluded to a discussion that a group of EU leaders had with each other, Macron, Merz, Alexander Stubb, Frederiksen, the Prime Minister of Denmark, several others, a discussion that they all had together about the need to protect their dear Zelensky, dear Volodymyr, from these horrible people in America who were out to get him. And, well, I can't help but think that what they were perhaps, possibly, quietly talking about with each other was the need for the Europeans to try to protect Zelensky from these potential American investigations. But the Europeans cannot offer protection because none of them is strong enough to withstand that kind of pressure from the United States. And, well, to repeat again, it seems to me that Zelensky now clearly is living on borrowed time. I had doubts about this. I wondered whether the Americans would really want to take the colossal risk of pulling him down. But it seems to me that that is very close to the point which we have reached. So, anyway, that's where we are in the war as of today. The battles continue. There's been less news from Pokrovsk, but the Russians do seem to be storming Guliapolye very quickly. And further north, northeast of Pokrovsk, the Russians now seem to be on the brink of capturing the villages, the village of Sofievka, close to the village of Sharkova, at Vladimirovka, which, according to some reports, the Russians have already captured. The most dramatic news, however, came not from Pokrovsk or Zaporozhye region, but more precisely from Siversk, where it seems to me that the Ukrainian garrison is now definitely in a trap, a cauldron, in fact, and where the Russians seem to have gained a significant further belt of territory inside Siversk. And perhaps even more dramatically, in Konstantinovka, the big city immediately to the east of Pokrovsk, where I get the sense that Ukrainian resistance is starting to collapse, possibly because the Russians are already intercepting the supplies. But all of that I am going to discuss in a lot more detail in my program tomorrow. This is where I have to stop today's program. Let me remind you again that you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. You can also check out our Substack site, and you can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, please remember, if you've liked this video, to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.